Hello, ahlan wa sahlan, and welcome to another episode of Arab Voices, coming to you from the studios of KPFT Houston since 2002. Houston's community station, 90.1 FM, FM HD1, Galveston 89.5 FM, and Huntsville 89.7 FM. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. This show is syndicated, and it airs on other radio stations in different cities in the U.S. and Europe. In this episode of Arab Voices, episode number 1111, we will talk about the protests at dozens of universities and colleges across the United States calling for an end to the ongoing Israeli genocide in Gaza, an immediate ceasefire, and are also calling on universities to divest from Israel. Since October 7, 2023, Israel has killed over 35,000 Palestinians, mostly women and children, injured more than 78,000, and destroyed most of the Gaza Strip, where 2.3 million Palestinians live. More than 11,000 Palestinians are still missing and presumed killed under the rubble. All of that is funded and supported by the United States government using taxpayers' money. Over the past few weeks, thousands of protesters, including students, faculty and staff, Muslims, Christians, Jews and others, started protesting at colleges across the United States against the ongoing genocide in Gaza and calling on their colleges to divest from Israel. Many of the universities called their local and state police to disperse the peaceful protests. Hundreds of students and some faculty were arrested at various colleges. The last report indicates over 1,700 students were arrested. At UT Austin in Texas, state troopers arrested many of the peaceful protesters, including Amir Qaddoumi, a Palestinian-American student at UT Austin and a member of the Palestine Solidarity Committee. Here is Amir explaining at a press conference held at UT Austin what happened, the reasons they are protesting, and their demands of UT Austin.
On Wednesday, April 24, the Palestine Solidarity Committee at the University of Texas at Austin planned a day of action on campus. The demonstration was set to take place in a public space and last throughout the day. It was set to feature speakers from a range of backgrounds to discuss pertinent topics surrounding the Gaza genocide and our role in opposing it. It promised to be yet another powerful demonstration against our university's complicity in the ongoing genocide. It promised to be peaceful, as all of PSC's demonstrations have been. What was supposed to be a moment of unity for UT's Palestinian community, filled with educational teachings, within a safe space for Palestinian students and their allies, became a fight for the preservation of our rights as students. What we saw unfold was not a confrontation or a clash with law enforcement. The sheer mass of officers, the army of state troopers armed as if preparing for war, were all indicative of a premeditated and coordinated attempt to viciously suppress our voice. The only escalation that happened that day is a result of this excessive show of force that turned into a senseless rampage where officers arrested not only protesters, but bystanders, uninvolved students, and even journalists. The complete lack of any restraint from UT police and President Jay Hartzell's subsequent commending of the incident are all dark indications that our university's leaders, that the safety of our students does not take precedence for our university's leaders. The unlawful mass arrest on Wednesday is a part of a troubling pattern of disregard of threats to the safety of our community, including our harassment by former Israeli soldiers and the stabbing of a Palestinian in West Campus. After more than 200 days of activism and enduring such hardships, advocating for the noble cause of justice and liberation for Palestinians, UT administration chose to enact their most brutal mistreatment of students yet. Our administration is responsible for instigating the brutal crackdown of our demonstration by the multi-agency force it called to our campus. Our administrators subjected their students to police brutality and robbed us of our fundamental right to speech and demonstration when they preemptively ordered an army of officers against us. Our president, Jay Hartzell, chose to endanger his own students instead of hearing and considering our demands. However, our reason for demonstrating and the reason we're here today is not simply to highlight the injustices on our campuses, but to continue advocating for the people of Palestine as they continue to endure a horrific genocide. Within the last few days alone, over 400 Palestinians were found in mass graves near Nasser Hospital in Gaza. Israel continues to restrict access to aid. They continue to starve the people of Gaza. They continue to use recordings of crying infants to lure Palestinians to their deaths. They execute innocent Gazans with their hands tied behind their backs. They continue to allow settler violence to run rampant in the West Bank. and our leaders and institutions continue to remain complicit. Our government just approved another $26 billion to the apartheid regime a few days ago, knowing full well it will be used to slaughter Palestinian children, bomb schools, and bomb homes. As students across the country rise up to demand that the universities divest from death, being met with mass arrests and suspensions like those at Columbia and utter police brutality at Emory, our united struggle for freedom for the Palestinian people thwarts these attempts to subjugate our students to intimidation. PSC's recent interim suspension as an organization is yet another installment in these attempts to suppress the broader student movement. It is a sign of the strength and effectiveness of our Palestinian narrative and activism. We in our community will not stand for UT's egregious behavior towards their students and nor their continued investments into the killing of Palestinians. We demand full accountability for the abuse of power and unlawful mass arrests conducted by UT police and ordered by UT administration. We demand that our university disclose their investments and divest from all companies that profit off the murder of our brothers and sisters in Gaza. We are grateful for the support of our community in this moment. We will remain steadfast to call for divestment, continue to call for divestment and accountability, and continue organizing for a just and liberated Palestine.
That was Amir Qaddoumi, a Palestinian-American student at UT Austin and a member of the Palestine Solidarity Committee. Students and faculty at Columbia University, including Jewish students, were also protesting the ongoing genocide in Gaza and were met with police force and accusations of being anti-Semite. Let's listen to some of the Jewish students speaking during the protest at Columbia University.
Divest all finances, including the endowment, from corporations that profit from Israeli apartheid, genocide, and occupation in Palestine. 2, provide financial transparency of all investments. And 3, ensure amnesty for all students and faculty arrested, disciplined, or fired in connection with the movement for Palestinian liberation.
As the media spins language of violence and ignores our story, they reveal their ignorance of the reality of Jewish life by portraying the Jewish people as a monolith and erasing the stories of the thousands of us fighting for a free Palestine. When I was marched out of the encampment in zip ties, I did not flinch. I walked into a space of love and joy, of solidarity and liberation, expecting to be met with violence by the institution I call home, simply because I cannot and could not stand to be complicit in our university's ongoing support for Israel's genocidal campaign. There are no universities left in Gaza, so we chose to reclaim our university for the people of Palestine. I was suspended from campus 3 hours before my arrest, along with 2 others of my peers, because I have been a vocal Jewish voice in the solidarity movement since early this year, and I was arrested on a violation for trespassing on my own campus.
I have never felt more proud to be Jewish and more in line with the values of my faith than when I was being taken out of Columbia's lawns with my hands zip-tied behind my back, alongside 107 other students, risking safety and suspension in order to push our university to divest from genocide, apartheid, and occupation in Palestine. In zip ties, I walked in the path of my Jewish ancestors, like my great-grandfather, who was part of the 1905 Russian Revolution. Like other Jews under the Tsarist regime, he was confined to the Pale of Settlement and experienced the constant threat of pogroms and the brutality of state violence. He risked his life to fight for a better world. I cannot, in good faith, honor his memory and ignore the checkpoints, the bombs, and the settler violence that Palestinians are subject to every single day. My college administration, my representatives in Congress, and my own president have continually acted as spokespeople for the Jewish community, equating anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism. They silence us, suspend us, create barriers for us to practice our faith so that they can say that we are a fringe group or that we're not real Jews.
These were Jewish students speaking at Columbia University during their protest against the Israeli genocide in Gaza. Apartheid Israel's war criminal, Benjamin Netanyahu, delivered a video message in which he described the protesters at college campuses in the U.S. as anti-Semitic. United States Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont, who is Jewish, delivered his own video message on April 25, 2024, addressing Benjamin Netanyahu.
No, Mr. Netanyahu, it is not anti-Semitic or pro-Hamas to point out that in a little over 6 months, your extremist government has killed 34,000 Palestinians and wounded more than 78,000, 70% of whom are women and children. It is not anti-Semitic to point out that your bombing has completely destroyed more than 221,000 housing units in Gaza, leaving more than 1 million people homeless, almost half the population. It is not anti-Semitic to note that your government has obliterated Gaza's civilian infrastructure, electricity, water, and sewage. It is not anti-Semitic to realize that your government has annihilated Gaza's healthcare system, knocking 26 hospitals out of service and killing more than 400 healthcare workers. It is not anti-Semitic to condemn your government's destruction of all of Gaza's 12 universities and 56 of its schools, with hundreds more damage, leaving 625,000 students with no educational opportunities. It is not anti-Semitic to agree with virtually every humanitarian organization in saying that your government, in violation of American law, has unreasonably blocked humanitarian aid coming into Gaza, creating the conditions in which so many thousands of children face malnutrition and famine. Mr. Netanyahu, anti-Semitism is a vile and disgusting form of bigotry that has done unspeakable harm to many millions of people. But please, do not insult the intelligence of the American people by attempting to distract us from the immoral and illegal war policies of your extremist and racist government. Do not use anti-Semitism to deflect attention from the criminal indictment you are facing in the Israeli courts. It is not anti-Semitic to hold you accountable for your actions.
That was Senator Bernie Sanders. By the way, on May 1, 2024, the U.S. Congress passed the Anti-Semitism Awareness Act, a bill described by the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, ADC, as, quote, steeped in anti-Palestinian and anti-Arab racism and dangerously conflates concern for Palestinian human rights with danger and hate, unquote. ADC also said it stifles legitimate criticism of the apartheid state of Israel and that of the Biden administration's complicity in the ongoing genocide. ADC said it firmly rejects this disingenuous attempt to paint pro-Palestinian and anti-war protesters as any sort of threat, particularly as these students and faculty are the ones facing a very real risk of being attacked by both police and pro-genocide agitators. Palestinian American Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib, serving Michigan's 12th Congressional District, delivered these remarks on the House floor on May 1, 2024, about sending militarized police and snipers to stop students from exercising their First Amendment rights and questioning why there is more outrage over anti-war protests than the genocide in Gaza and the killing of over 35,000 Palestinians.
I am deeply concerned about the escalating repression of First Amendment protected speech and assembly on college campuses across our country. To all the elected university boards and appointed presidents, it needs to be very clear, your students' constitutional rights doesn't end when they enter your campus grounds. Mr. Speaker, I'd like to submit for the record the statements from the ACLU and from Bend the Arc.
Without objection.
In the ACLU statement, Mr. Speaker, it says, quote, as you fashion responses to the activism of your students and faculty and staff, it is essential that you not sacrifice principles of academic freedom and free speech that are at a core to the educational mission of your respected institutions. From Bend the Arc statement, protest, quote, protest is essential to our movement work and must be protected. And we firmly stand against anti-Semitism being used as an excuse to threaten free speech and criticism of university and U.S. policy. To be clear, criticism of American policy towards Israel is not inherently anti-Semitic, end of quote. Mr. Speaker, dissent is a fundamental American value. From the civil rights movement to anti-war protests to the movement for Black lives, immigrant rights, our country has a long history of student-leading movements for change and challenging the status quo that oppresses and normalizes genocides across the world. I am deeply moved by the courageous young people in more than 100 encampments at colleges across our nation that are demanding divestment in support of a genocide in Gaza and apartheid government of Israel. I had the opportunity, Mr. Speaker, to visit an encampment at University of Michigan that has public programming. They put it online for families and on various issues. The day I went, they were recognizing the anniversary of the Armenian genocide and having someone also speak about the connectivity to the Palestinian Nakba. It was inspiring to see these brave students across races of all faiths and backgrounds standing side by side in solidarity to protest for peace. From Jummah prayer to Shabbat, they are coming together in a way I wish my colleagues would welcome. Sending in militarized police forces and even snipers to stop these students for exercising their First Amendment right is truly disgusting. My colleagues are so outraged by students opposing genocide and apartheid, but many of these same members were completely silent last year when we saw the dramatic increase of threats, literally death threats on historical Black colleges and universities across the country. These state-sanctioned violence, including the arrests and threatened felony prosecutions of students, can only be seen as an explicit effort to silence students and take away their First Amendment rights. No student, Mr. Speaker, not one, should be met with academic repercussions or policy brutality on their own campuses for exercising peacefully their right to free speech and assembly. Why is it, Mr. Speaker, that my colleagues and every headline from mainstream media is more concerned and outrage about these protests than they are about the over 35,000 Palestinians killed in Gaza? 70% of them are women and children. There are no universities left in Gaza. No outrage. Multiple mass graves have been uncovered at several locations that Israeli forces have recently withdrawn from. 200 bodies found at El Shifa Hospital, literally fresh bodies found with their hands tied behind their backs, naked. Where is the outrage for these war crimes? And this is not just me. This is the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights. Our government isn't just complicit to this genocide, we're actively participating. Students are occupying their campuses to peacefully protest for an end to these atrocities and divestment in this genocide and apartheid. They are even renaming some of the buildings after Palestinian children that have been killed. These students should be praised for standing up for what they believe in, not vilified, smeared with misinformation campaigns and silence. I call on these universities to end the repressive tactics, to exercise restraint, to denounce the ongoing police brutality and stop suppressing the very activism, academic freedom, and thoughtful debate that they seek to inspire in their students. Mr. Speaker, we don't want to see an apology years later. Mm-mm. No. We want to see action today to protect these students. We don't want to have you all in 10 years praise the same students for doing what was right years later. We don't want to see that. We need it now. They deserve it now.
That was Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib. Congressman Jamal Bowman, serving New York's 16th Congressional District, also delivered some remarks on the House floor on May 1st on the arrest and removal of protesters from the campus of Columbia University.
Mr. Speaker, I've had guns pulled on me multiple times by law enforcement simply for being a black man in America. And now I see guns being drawn on peaceful protesters at Columbia University. When I was 11 years old, I was a victim of police brutality simply for being black in America. And now I see that brutality being inflicted on peaceful protesters at Columbia University. And for what? Simply exercising their First Amendment rights to peacefully assemble as they protest the collective punishment and murder of civilians in Gaza. 100,000 killed and injured, mostly women and children, protesting our taxpayer dollars going to Benjamin Netanyahu to continue this mass murder. That is their right. They are supposed to push us to stand for what this flag represents. Are we in a police state, or is this a democracy?
The gentleman's time has expired.
We must stand with our young people and demand justice and freedom.
The gentleman's time has expired.
And everyone in this world.
That was Congressman Jamal Bowman. David Hurst, editor-in-chief of Middle East Eye, an independent online news organization, talked about the parallels between the anti-Vietnam War protests in 1968 and the ongoing global demonstrations against the Gaza War. In a recorded video, he highlighted how these protests have reignited support for the Palestinian cause and promoted a new generation of American Jews to challenge the claim that Zionism owns their narrative. David Hurst also delved into the student protests at universities across the U.S. and how Columbia has been at the center of the revolt once again, with an encampment protesting Israel's assault sparking a wave of similar actions on college campuses across the country and Europe. Let's listen in.
In January 1968, the Viet Cong launched a surprise attack on South Vietnam and the U.S. Army. It became known as the Tet Offensive. It was supposed to trigger an insurrection in the South, but that never materialized. What did happen was a meltdown in American public opinion. The Pentagon came under unprecedented criticism for its optimistic assessment of the course of the Vietnam War. A credibility gap opened up between the then US President Lyndon B. Johnson and Americans. LBJ himself lost faith in the way his top general was fighting in Vietnam and replaced him. In 1968, Columbia University in New York became the epicenter of the anti-war protest, spurred on by the university's ties to the defense industry. Students occupied five buildings and took its dean, Henry Coleman, hostage for 36 hours. The police were called in. There were hundreds of student arrests, injuries, a strike, and then the resignation of Columbia's president, Grayson Kirk. Anti-war protests reached a climax outside the Democratic National Convention in Chicago and were later seen as one of the reasons for the election of the Republican, Richard Nixon, as president. Meanwhile, the anti-war protests spread like wildfire to Europe, first to West Berlin and then to Paris, where in May 1968, a worker and student revolt triggered 10 weeks of street battles. At one point, the Élysée lost its nerve and French President Charles de Gaulle scuttled to Germany. The next day, 500,000 workers marched through Paris chanting Adieu de Gaulle. Does all this sound familiar? There is a major student revolt going on in US campuses right now over Joe Biden's backing of Israel's war in Gaza. Once again, Columbia University is its epicenter. Last night, students occupied Hamilton Hall, and after the university started suspending more students. This building was occupied by protests in 1968. The protests have spread to 30 other universities and colleges. At the conservative Ivy League Yale, students are demanding the university divest from all weapons manufacturing companies contributing to Israel's assault on Palestine. Yale has exchanged students with seven Israeli universities. Harvard has programs with three of these universities, while Columbia has relations with four of them. As in 1968, many of these protests have been met by police violence. Over 900 students have been arrested since the first clashes at Columbia over 2 weeks ago. They've also spread to Britain and to Europe. at Trinity College, Cambridge, the portrait of Lord Balfour, the British Foreign Secretary responsible for a statement recognising the right of Jews to a homeland in Palestine, was defaced and slashed before being removed by the university. London has just seen its 13th national demonstration since the war began. The protests against the war in Gaza, in their persistence and size, are only matched by the million-plus demonstration against Tony Blair's decision to invade Iraq, which in 2003 was the biggest of its kind. In 1968, the targets were the Pentagon and de Gaulle and his repressive paternalism. Today's targets of the anti-war movement is Israel, the pro-Israel lobby, and its chief armourers, America, Britain, and Germany. Spearheading the revolt against Zionism is a new generation of Jew who is turning up in increasing numbers at these protests. The Gaza war is causing an unprecedented debate among Jewry, with leading intellectuals like the Canadian journalist and activist Naomi Klein arguing that Zionism is, and I quote, a false idol that has taken the idea of the promised land and turned it into a deed of sale for a militaristic ethno-state. These events will not be without their consequences. The first is that for the first time in history, Gaza, both its people and its militias and fighters, are displaying a determination to stand and fight, which the PLO and Yasser Arafat never showed. Palestinians now have a leadership which will not give up its major demand and which commands their respect. The second consequence is that a new generation is coming of age in America, the only country that can stop this conflict by withdrawing its military, political, and economic support for Israel. It is still the only country that Israel listens to and takes seriously. The Jews amongst this generation are horrified by what is being done in their name, horrified by how their religion has been morphed into an apology for ethnic cleansing, horrified by how their proud and painful heritage has been reduced into a license to kill, horrified by the power exerted by Israel over the US Congress, the UK Parliament, and every mainstream party in Europe. Jews are challenging the claim that Zionism owns their narrative. For their pains, they're accused by their own community of being traitors. They're called Kapos. This is the word the Jews assigned to the Nazi SS to supervise forced labor were given. They're called self-hating or simply animals. But for me, they are the biggest single source of hope in this bleak landscape.
That was David Hurst, Editor-in-Chief of Middle East Eye. You're listening to Arab Voices, originating on KPFT Houston since 2002 and syndicated on other radio stations in different cities in the U.S. and Europe. This is Saeed, Executive Producer and host of Arab Voices. Part of apartheid Israel's ongoing genocide against the Palestinians is to destroy everything, including hospitals, clinics, ambulances, cultural centers, supermarkets, banks, grocery stores, malls, schools, colleges, and universities, residential buildings, and a whole lot more. And indeed, Israel has destroyed all of these in the Gaza Strip over the past few months, and it's still at it. Apartheid Israel is also after those outside of Gaza that speak against its ongoing genocide and atrocities. On April 18, 2024, Israel arrested a leading Palestinian legal scholar, Professor Nadira Shalhoub Kevorkian, based in Jerusalem. She was detained over comments made on a podcast more than a month earlier and was later released. I met Professor Nadira in Houston back in 2017 when she spoke at Rice University. But she also spoke recently at the World Academic Forum for Palestine, Genocide in Gaza. It was a transnational forum on the ongoing genocide in Gaza held at the University of Houston on April 6th and 7th, 2024, organized by Scholars Against the War on Palestine. Professor Nadira Shalhoub Kevorkian spoke at that event via Zoom about 10 days before she was arrested. Let's listen in.
Thank you, organizers, for organizing such an important event amidst this very painful genocide. My intervention will look at the sacralized, securitized, and ontologized matrix of overkillability during this genocide in Gaza. Now, the ongoing genocide in Gaza, with the loaded evidence of Gazans living, dying, and witnessing scattered injured body parts and wounded flesh and soul, poses the question of the political place given to the colonized dead body, evident in the Israeli state's overkill ability, the wounding, the starvation, the cutting fuel, the displacement, and more, and apparent in the colonized scattered flesh on Gaza's soil. In my reflections today, I will use the Arabic word ashla to refer to the scattered body parts and dismembered flesh as an anxiously reiterated and repeated concept and concern raised by Gazans, whose invocation of ashla helps me analyze their perception of its functionality and unpack the political sacralized and securitized work of its brutality. Ashla, I argue, pushes beyond dismantling the biopolitical and necropolitical domain of the racial command operated during the ongoing genocide. Ashla requires us to read its inscription. Inscription dismembered, wounded, and dying flesh body of the colonized, and the centrality of that and the overkilling in the Zionist ideology, in the Zionist founding and continual violence. So the agonies in seeing the ashlas over, among, and beneath demolished areas in Gaza, the gathering of the shattered body parts by family members and loved ones to maintain its humanity, to enlive it in amidst death, and the constant mentioning, collecting, witnessing, searching for ashla among Gazans, with the physical, the psychological, the social pain, the social loss it brings, became a constant worry among Gazans, a source of fear, but also a source of inner mobilization against its fragmentation. Thinking through ashla allows us to concentrate on the shattered flesh and the debilitation of the body, as observed by Jasper Poir, when she says the body is seen as cognizant to death, is the body that is already debilitated in biopolitical terms in her book, Right to Maim, but it's thinking also through the fragmented flesh, the cut body parts into pieces of flesh, when I'm thinking also through Hortense Piller's work, when she says the flesh, that 0 degree of social conceptualization that does not escape concealment under the brush of discourse or the reflexes of iconography. The ashla, that dismembered, bleeding, and wounded flesh revealed the culmination of unliving. The main intention of my short intervention is to suggest that there is a lot more to the desecration of life and death, the flattening of Gaza spaces to turn them into collective graveyards, turning it into ashla, scattered body parts, smashed, decomposed, unidentified flesh. And I want to argue that the decomposed body parts and the scattered death in the ongoing genocide in Gaza takes us to one of the core dimensions of fascist ideology, the dead, the flesh, the blood, and in Zionist settler colonial brutality, the ashla. Witnessing the ongoing genocide in Gaza, the loss of lives, the loss of children I interviewed and learned from, my students, my lost family, friends, health workers, journalists, teachers, colleagues, the flattening, destruction, the domicide, the unchilding, the scholasticized, as Ghada Aqil stated yesterday in her testimony, no painkillers in Gaza, but the killers. I really want to speak to you today about the overkilling of the killed via the Palestinian ashla, looking closely at three pillars of the genocidal attack on Gaza and on Gaza's ashla. The first is sacralized overkilling. Now, we've heard from Reverend Munzer Ishaq about the sacralization or the theologization or the weaponization of the Bible, but unpacking sacralization embedded in the destruction of the native's body, the native home, land, city, and its replacement and settlement along the global and local ordering of power and politics created drastic, brutal transformation in Gaza, violated the psychic and social fabric of the native community, and provoked further violence in Gaza, in the West Bank, and in Jerusalem. So cartographically unpacking the destruction embedded in the sacralization of the political was evident, for example, in Benjamin Netanyahu's statements on October 28, when he said, "You must remember what Amalek has done to you," says our Holy Bible. And we do remember, and we are fighting. Or when Netanyahu told his soldiers on November 3rd, the basis of the existence of thousand-year-old nation of Israel is the constant struggle for our lives and freedom. The current fight against the Hamas murderers is another chapter in the story. Remember what Amalek did to you. This is a war between the sons of light and the sons of darkness. Or when Knesset Foreign Affairs and Defense Committee member Boaz Bismuth, the Likud, from the Likud party, said, "We must not forget that the cruel, monstrous, innocent civilian from Gaza had an active role in the pogrom inside Israel's settlement. It's forbidden to show mercy to the cruel. There is no place for any humanitarian gesture. The memory of Amalek must be wiped out." This pseudo-religious spin, this weaponization of the Bible, it's necropolitical, since Amalek annihilative violence invokes support from the divine to exterminate the Amalekites, interpreted today as every Palestinian. So Netanyahu's base of political support among militant settlers find inspiration from these violent biblical texts. So embracing the Amalek mentality is what the biblical scholar Walter Wink calls the myth of redemption violence, and Amalek mentality that was used against the Native American who endured a genocidal war of settler colonialism for hundreds of years, against the Hutu by the Tutsi in Rwanda, and today by Jewish Zionists and their global allies against Palestinians. And when watching the ongoing genocide in Gaza today, when the international community fails us as we Palestinians continue to struggle against the carceral collective punishment and the overkillability of necropolitics, when geopolitics and its politics of breeding fails us as babies in incubators are being slowly suffocated to death, when human rights and humanitarian laws fails us as bodies, entire families and communities are searching for food, but food workers are also killed, and individuals are massacred when trying to fetch for food. Framing Palestinians as Amalekites dispossess us of life, of homes, of neighborhood, of hospitals, schools, and cities. When academic institutions fail us, as universities are totally demolished, and scholars are facing extrajudicial killing, and doctors like my friend Fadel Abu Hain, as others are targeted, shot, and killed by snipers, we realize the genocidal power of the sacralization of politics. Such religious claims with their method of elimination and techniques for policing and governing a slaughterhouse against the Amalekites means that anyone who meets Palestinians can kill them, even as babies in incubators. When Palestinians are framed as Amalek, where barbaric human animals do not have children or families, as someone said, we realize not only the centrality of death and the smashing and scattering of body parts in the Zionist settler colonial politics and mentality, but as I wish to argue, the centrality of death in world politics, and here is empire. When the book, the Bible, is weaponized for ethnic cleansing and mass destruction, when the Bible is turned into a political capital that its only profit is deadly profit, the overkillability of the colonized to gain the oil, the natural gas, the weapons manufacturers, we must think otherwise. My question is whether we need to look at the destructive power of settler states justified by sacralized and securitized theologies. In the Zionist settler colonial, we heard from politicians considering using the nuclear weapons. Yes, they call it the nuclear option, the Samson option, again weaponizing the Bible. And when the destruction is divine, the state makes itself into that which must be preserved and protected indefinitely. Just to remind you all, with Blinken's statement that the U.S. will be with Israel today, tomorrow, and every day, and other statements that we just heard. When I move to the securitized theology, which is another religion, yeah, security theology, as I say in my book of 2014, I explain how fear constructed securitization and defense in such a way as to make them central aspects of Israeli settler colonial apparatus. It allowed leaders, policymakers, to market the ideology of the whole world is against us, so the Palestinians want to throw us in the sea, and the notion that we must defend ourselves, as we've seen in this war. It is my contention that in order to maintain a productive global and local industry and political economy that produces and reproduces fear, Israeli security was transformed into a religion. Yeah? This theology has been combined with Zionist biblical claims of the Jewish birthright to the promised land in order to create a new settler colonial theology in Israel. In so far, the divine claims of Jewish chosenness and return serve Israel's narrative as a legitimate and sovereign state. They also work to endorse Israeli violence against Palestinians as a security necessity. Yeah. And the third point in my matrix, my analytical matrix, is ontological otherness. So how can we think about political genocidal carcerality of sacralized and securitized global politics embedded in the politics of Ashla, of the scattered Palestinian bodies that we're seeing today in Gaza? What about thinking through the coloniality of being, or more, the coloniality of non-being, because Palestinians ontologically are considered non-being? Ontology, as I see it, is a philosophy of power. And while coloniality of power referred to the interrelation among modern forms of exploitation and domination, and the coloniality of knowledge had to do with the impact of colonization on the different areas of knowledge production, coloniality of being would make primary reference to the lived experience of colonization and its impact on life and on death. And this is why Palestinians' death and living is considered a non-being at the limits of the humanity. Fanon deploys the existential expression of coloniality in relation to the colonial experience in its racial order and racial ordering. And he concentrates his attention in the trauma of the encounter with the imperial and racial other. Look a Negro, Fanon talks about. This is the point of departure for Fanon to begin to elaborate what might be referred as the existentiala of the subject of the coloniality of being. Thinking ontologically via the genocide, all I see, all I witness is the lethal coloniality of being. Let me conclude. The centrality of death that leaves no traces because it's in a schlep, in the scattered body parts, in the smashed body parts, apparent in those three pillars, the sacralized, the securitized, and the ontologized, lethal coloniality, expose Zionism, leaving us in a spiral assemblage, spiral context of overkilling, of unending ashla, scattered, smashed, decomposed, when the ability to gather data, to count, to see, to comprehend, to collect body part or bury them is also being erased by the colonizer. So if I'm allowed just to, for a minute, to show you the various body parts that we are seeing today in Gaza, whether in incubators or whether on the land, we see clearly that the situation requires real intervention. It's in Ashla, yeah? And Ashla really exposes the centrality of death, because the centrality of death is really, again, leaves no traces. It's in Ashla, in those three pillars, that I see our need to think more. Ashla exposes the greedy appetite of the colonizer that prohibits thinkability of Palestinian oneness in its possibility to be, to constitute itself as the whole entity, therefore the need to scatter Palestinian, to scatter them into Ashla, yeah? And rise above its uprooting and dismemberment. The turning of Gaza, Palestine, into dismembered Ashla, as Gazans' voices have insisted, and Gazan children have kept on mentioning their collection of the Ashla or their search for Ashla, reveals the savage encroachment of power that facilitates settler colonial domination by preying on the decomposition of wounded and scattered Palestinian flesh In this necroeconomy, with its racial culmination of overkillability, because it's not enough to kill, it's that need to scatter, to kill, to smash, the global political complicity is unveiled. The yearning for destruction is what we are witnessing today. Such overkilling made Selma, who lost her son during Gazan genocide 2 days ago, explain, "I knew him from his clothes, but he was smashed, totally smashed, a schlep." To challenge the sacralized, securitized, and ontologized matrix of overkillability in which Zionist power is spoke through blood, one has to think through the question and power of the smashed and scattered dead and overkilled, the Palestinian Ashla, and act and mobilize locally, regionally, and globally against it. Thank you.
That was Professor Nadira Shalhoub Kevorkian speaking on April 7th, 2024 at the World Academic Forum for Palestine Genocide in Gaza, held at the University of Houston, organized by Scholars Against the War on Palestine. Professor Nadira Shalhoub Kevorkian spoke at that event via Zoom. Did you know that since October 7th, 2023, anti-Muslim incidents in the United States have skyrocketed? In a new report titled Fatal, the Resurgence of Anti-Muslim Hate, the Council on American-Islamic Relations documents 8,061 complaints received nationwide in 2023, showing even higher spike than after Trump's Muslim ban. According to the report, nearly half of all complaints received in 2023 were reported in the final 3 months of the year. The report notes that the 2023 wave of anti-Muslim incidents was a 56% jump over the previous year and surpassed even the period following the implementation of President Trump's Muslim ban, which saw a 32% jump over the previous year. Let's listen to Farah Afifi, Research and Advocacy Coordinator at the Council on American-Islamic Relations and co-author of this new report, talking about the key findings and recommendations in that report.
I'd first like to start off with a graphic from our report, which demonstrates an analysis of the total number of complaints that CARE receives on a year-by-year basis over the last several years. As you'll see in the graph, the number of complaints that CARE receives generally increases over time, with an important exception in 2022, when we mark the first ever decline in the number of complaints received by CARE offices. That decline, however, did not last for very long, as in 2023, we not only saw a 56% increase in the number of complaints reported to CARE, but we also recorded the highest number of complaints ever reported to CARE offices in our group's 30-year history. To delve deeper into the 2023 data, we received a total of 8,061 complaints from across the country. In terms of complaint breakdown, immigration and asylum cases continue to be the highest reported category to CARE offices. Similarly, as in 2022, employment and education-related complaints are among the highest reported complaints to CARE offices. However, I will note here, and I will discuss this in further depth into the presentation, we saw a significant increase in the number of employment and education-related complaints reported to our offices over the previous year. Lastly, I would like to note here that unlike 2022, hate crimes and hate incidents are now among the highest reported categories to CARE offices, coming in at 607 complaints in 2023. To look at the 2023 data from a different angle, I'd also like to show you all a month-by-month analysis of the total number of complaints reported to CARE offices. As you'll see in the graph, from January through September 2023, the total number of complaints reported to our offices remained relatively stable and steady, with an important exception in October, when we saw a significant spike and the total number of complaints reported to our offices, a spike that continued on throughout the rest of the year. October 2023, of course, marks the escalation of hostilities in Israel and Palestine, as well as the beginning of the latest round of violence from the Israeli government against Palestinian civilians in Gaza. In order to get a better understanding of what the 2023 data would have looked like had the events of October 2023 not occurred, we decided to compare the monthly average of complaints received in 2022 with the monthly average received just in those first 9 months in 2023, so the pre-October period. We found that in 2022, we received an average of 430 complaints per month. In 2023, again, just in those first 9 months, the pre-October period, we received 498 complaints per month. What we can conclude from this data is that pre-October 2023 would have likely seen a slight increase in the total number of complaints reported to care offices. However, I would like to emphasize that this increase likely would have been incredibly slight and nothing like the actual spike that we did end up seeing, particularly in those final 3 months of the year. Now, I'd also like to discuss some of the key and unprecedented trends emerging from the 2023 data. In particular, we saw a significant increase in the number of everyday attacks on Muslims and American Muslim communities across the country. In 2022, we reported receiving 117 complaints of hate crimes and hate incidents. In 2023, that number rose by a staggering 419% to 607 complaints. I also want to highlight that 472 of those 607 complaints came just within the final 3 months of the year. This confirms what we have long known about 2023, particularly those final months, which is that everyday Muslims and American Muslim communities have had their safety threatened and have been under attack due to the Israeli government's continued violence against Palestinians in Gaza, as well as the United States' justification of that violence through Islamophobic and blatantly anti-Palestinian rhetoric. The next trends I'd also like to discuss are the increases that we have seen in employment and education-related complaints in 2023. As you'll see in a graph on the left, in an analysis between the number of employment discrimination complaints received in 2022 and 2023, we marked a 113% increase in the total number of employment discrimination complaints reported to care offices. In a similar analysis of education-related complaints, and that includes both bullying as well as education discrimination at the K-12 as well as at the university level, we noted a 219% increase in the total number of education-related complaints reported to care offices during this period. This again confirms what we have known about 2023, again those final 3 months, which is that employees and students had become targets for attack, not just by external organizations or individuals who sought to personally harass or dox them, but also by employers and universities themselves who sought to suppress speech in support of Palestinian human rights. This data is incredibly concerning for the state of American Muslim civil liberties and civil rights. However, I do want to highlight that our report also notes a number of successes throughout the year. In particular, I want to highlight the expansion of equal recognition of Muslim religious identity that we have seen throughout 2023. For example, we saw several cities, including Minneapolis and New York City, permit the adhan to be called over loudspeakers, which is the Muslim call to prayer. We've also seen a number of states adopt the practice of recognizing a Muslim American Heritage Month. That includes New Jersey and Georgia in 2023, as well as North Carolina in 2024, bringing that total up to at least 8 states across the country. Finally, we also noted that a number of school districts across at least 6 different states have added the observation of one of 2 major Muslim holidays to their yearly calendars. Before we conclude, I'd also like to highlight a number of recommendations emerging from our report. First and foremost, CARE continues to call on the United States government to call for a permanent and immediate ceasefire in Gaza. As the data demonstrates, the Israeli government's campaign of violence against Palestinian civilians in Gaza, as well as the United States' justification of that violence through dehumanizing anti-Muslim and anti-Palestinian rhetoric, has significantly threatened the lives of Muslims, Arabs, and Palestinians, not just across this country, but across the world. The second key recommendation I'd like to highlight is our continued call for the Biden administration to suspend the dissemination of the FBI's federal watch list. In a special report we released last year from a 2000, over 98% of the names on the federal watch list were Muslim or Arabic sounding names. CARE has continued to challenge this discriminatory and unconstitutional watch list, particularly through a lawsuit filed on behalf of plaintiffs who have faced negative repercussions due to current or past placement on the watch list. That, of course, includes Mayor Mohammed Khairullah of New Jersey, who was infamously revoked entry to the White House, likely due to his own past placement on the watch list. Before we officially conclude, I'd also like to add one final data analysis here that was produced after the report's authorship. Nevertheless, we find it significant to highlight here with the remainder of the report's findings. In order to get a better understanding of this most recent wave of anti-Muslim hate that we have seen in 2023, we decided to compare it to what we consider to be the two most recent waves of anti-Muslim hate. Namely, one, former President Trump's announcement of the Muslim ban in December 2015, and his implementation of that ban when he assumed office in January 2017. In a comparison of the total number of complaints that CARE received in the 3 months following each inciting incident, we found that following the beginning of the Biden-backed genocide in Gaza, we received 3,578 complaints. In the 3 months following the announcement of Trump's Muslim ban, we received 1,098 complaints. And in the 3 months following the implementation of that ban, we received 1,813 complaints. What we can conclude from this data is that not only is this wave that we are witnessing here in response to the Biden-backed genocide in Gaza greater than either of those other waves on their own, but it is also greater than both of them combined. We find this data incredibly concerning and find it important to highlight here as well with our report's findings.
That was Farah Afifi, Research and Advocacy Coordinator at the Council on American Islamic Relations and co-author of the new report, Fatal: The Resurgence of Anti-Muslim Hate. I have a link to the full report on our website, arabvoices.net. You've been listening to Arab Voices, originating on KPFT Houston and syndicated on other radio stations in different cities in the U.S. and Europe. Our shows are archived online, and you can listen to them by visiting arabvoices.net. And that does it for the show today. Thanks for listening. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Until we meet next week, peace on earth.